Hello and welcome, Iris listeners. This is hour three of the Des Moines Register. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan, and we begin this hour with the obituaries. From Des Moines, Judith Pruchnicki died on Tuesday, June 1st at the age of 76 in Des Moines after a year-long battle with leukemia. Judy will be remembered at a visitation on Wednesday, June 30th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Isles Dunn's Chapel, 2121 Grand Avenue, and her funeral will be on Thursday, July 1st at 10 a.m. at Grace United Methodist Church, 3700 Cottage Grove Avenue in Des Moines. There will be a reception to follow at the Des Moines Botanical Garden from noon to 2 p.m. She will be privately interred at Glendale Cemetery on University Avenue. Judy grew up in Clarion and moved to Chicago in the 1960s to become a flight attendant / service manager for TWA. Her flights regularly took her from Chicago to London, Paris, Tel Aviv, and Rome. In 1981, she married Michael Pruchnicki, and they moved to Des Moines in 1989. Since then, she dedicated her time as a volunteer with various organizations, including the Des Moines Founders Garden Club, PEO, the PTA, Festival of Trees, Young Artist Competition, and the Des Moines Symphony's Auxiliary. In 2018, the City of Des Moines Parks Department awarded her Volunteer of the Year for her work planting disease-resistant elm trees. Her life in Des Moines was filled with her care for her family, her love of cooking, and her delight in gardening. The family spent the summers in Clarion at Lake Cornelia, where she enjoyed sailing, swimming, and watching sunsets. Judy was vivacious and charming, never losing the spirit of adventure that took her around the world. She is survived by her husband, Michael, their two children, James and Elizabeth Pruchnicki, her sisters, Betty and Sherry Gitz, and a devoted extended family. She was preceded in death by her parents, George and Muriel Gitz. Any gifts made in memory of Judy Pruchnicki should be sent to the Des Moines Botanical Garden. Carol Morrison, age 89, of Minburn, died peacefully on June 24th at Kennybrook Village in Grimes. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, July 1st at Brandt Funeral Home in Dallas Center, with visitation 1 hour prior to services. Burial will be at Elmwood Cemetery in Minburn. Carol was born on November 22, 1931, in Guthrie Center to Charles and Ursel Reed Morrison. He attended Des Moines Technical High School and served in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War. Carol drove truck for Briggs Transportation for 30 years and was a member of the Teamsters Union Local Number 147. Ruth Ann Duffield and Carol were married in 1958 and lived in Minburn for 47 years. They loved to travel together during retirement and spent 20 winters fishing and sailing while living at their home in Gulf Shores, Alabama. Carol enjoyed dancing and country music. He had a real sweet tooth, was a baker of apple and cherry pies, and couldn't go a day without eating a Blue Bunny ice cream bar, or two, or three. Those who knew Carol well will miss this sweet, feisty man who had some great one-liners. His twinkly blue eyes showed his love for those around him and will be forever in our hearts. Carol was preceded in death by his wife, Ruth Ann, in 2012, his parents and his sister, Norma Grebel. He is survived by his children, Jerry Morrison, spouse Michelle of Dallas Center, John Morrison, spouse Kim of Fort Dodge, and Penny James, as well as many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Memorial contributions may be directed to Suncrest Hospice, 5959 Village View Drive, Suite 100, West Des Moines, Iowa, 50266. That concludes today's obituaries. I'll turn to the sports section now and read the headlines there. At the top of the page, "It can change the game." This is a quote, and the subtitle says, "How Iowa Prep Athletes Think NIL Could Affect Recruitment." That story is written by Matthew Bain. Chicago's Horner starts rehab stint in Iowa early. This is a column by Tommy Birch. College football open for business again, and that's Randy Peterson's column. The final story on the front page is Bush Ends Hendricks Winning Streak by Dan Gelston of the Associated Press. I will start at the top of the page with Matthew Bain's story, It Can Change the Game, and that's in quotes in the headline. Caden Proctor has been busy this summer, like really busy. Now that prospects are able to visit college campuses again, Proctor, the Southeast Polk offensive lineman, has loaded his calendar with visits. Proctor is a consensus five-star, top 10 national talent in the 2023 class, with offers from just about everywhere. He took a two-day unofficial trip to Alabama last week. He followed that with visits to Iowa and Missouri. Earlier in June, Proctor also visited Iowa State, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Arizona, and Arizona State. Translation. Still at least 18 months from signing with a school, Proctor, the 6'8", 340-pound phenom, is already one of the country's most sought-after talents. And he doesn't give a lick about name, image, and likeness. Starting July 1st, college student athletes in some states will be able to start making money off their name, image, and likeness, often referred to as NIL, through avenues such as endorsements or autographs. Schools are already preparing for how they can best incorporate the potential for such money-making opportunities into their recruiting. Proctor said he hasn't discussed name, image, and likeness possibilities with any school, though. He said, if endorsement opportunities come up while he's in college, then great, he'll look into it. But he won't let potential advertising deals determine where he goes to school. I don't really think too much about that, how much money I'm going to be getting and all that, Proctor said. I just want to feel loved, have a good life, be happy with what I'm doing, be content with all the coaches, have good relationships, and work up to the next level. Of course, not every prospect thinks like Proctor. The Register spoke with elite Iowa athletes to get a sense of how such compensation may factor into their recruitment. NIL approaches vary by prospect. Take Omaha Beaulieu, for instance. Earlier in June, Beaulieu, the number two talent in the 2023 men's basketball class, according to Rivals, announced he was transferring from Waukee to Monteverde Academy in Florida for his last 2 years of high school. He is Iowa's most highly regarded basketball prospect since Harrison Barnes was the country's number one recruit in 2010. Ever since the summer after his freshman year, when he emerged as a top five national talent, Beaulieu has been clear. If high school graduates can enter the NBA draft by the time he graduates in 2023, that's what he wants to do. That's led some to believe the 6'8" mega talent would also prefer playing a year in the NBA G League over a season in college. The G League has become a more viable path for five-star talents in recent years, as nationally recognized players like Jalen Green and Jonathan Kuminga have picked that route. Opportunities for name, image, and likeness compensation could change all that. If Beaulieu could profit off himself during his one college season, he said that would reduce the G League's main perceived advantage over college: making money. Those elite schools, they put you on a bigger platform, Beaulieu told the Register. That makes your brand even more valuable, especially to other people, and it brings in more money. Beaulieu will be a national-level athlete if he goes to college, so he would get national-level name, image, and likeness opportunities, where most student-athletes would likely profit off more regional or local advertising opportunities. For Beaulieu, the biggest opportunity may boil down to his Instagram following. He has nearly 17,000 followers right now. The more followers he has, the more money he could receive from advertisers for posting a photo of himself using their product. The marketing firm Open Doors estimated that during his college career at Clemson, Trevor Lawrence could have made roughly $15,000 per advertising post on Instagram. He had close to 800,000 followers at the time. Beaulieu said every school recruiting him has discussed how their program's brand could elevate Beaulieu's brand and get him those followers that could land him thousands of dollars with every advertising post. Tyler Sass, Beaulieu's personal coach, confirmed that some schools are emphasizing name, image, and likeness opportunities. Kentucky's whole sales pitch is, you can go to the G League and make the million there, or you can make more at Kentucky because we're the biggest show in basketball and you'll be the biggest name in basketball, Sass said. For some people, it can change the game. Beaulieu believes if he goes to a school with a strong enough platform, he could make as much in college as he would during a year in the G League. If you went to Kentucky, if you went to Duke, if you went to UNC, those types of places, you're going to be seen. You're on the national scene your whole life from the time you get there, Beaulieu said. So that's definitely going to play a big role in my decision. Council Bluffs Lincoln 2022 combo guard Josh Dix, a three-star prospect with offers from Iowa, Wake Forest, Drake, and several others, said Hawkeye head coach Fran McCaffrey talked to him about name, image, and likeness during his June 8th visit in Iowa City. He said McCaffrey believes there will be national rules governing the issue, in quotes, soon, and that Iowa would provide its players assistance with building their brands to make money. While he doesn't think the issue will play much of a role in his college decision, Dick said he could see it being a larger factor for other prospects around the country, especially if there aren't national guidelines, so compensation laws vary state to state. I feel like that would hurt their recruiting process a lot more and make it harder for states without compensation to get better recruits, Dick said, because everyone wants to play their sport, obviously, but they all love money, too. Checking in with cream-of-the-crop football recruits. Southeast Polk four-star 2022 safety Xavier Nwankwo told the Register that both Ohio State and Texas A&M talked to him about name, image, and likeness opportunities during his official visits there. The Buckeyes talked about how Columbus, Ohio has 17 Fortune 500 companies in the area, and they would be eager to advertise with Ohio State football players. At Texas A&M, Nwankwo said coaches talked about how playing on the football team would help him, quote, tremendously, to get endorsement opportunities with the state's many Aggie alumni. Nwankwo said name, image, and likeness opportunities could play a role in his decision, but not significantly. I mean, I feel like it can help, he said, but a school can't reach out and help out for you, so it's basically through yourself anyway. For Proctor, his hesitance to heavily consider compensation opportunities when choosing a school boils down to the potential of empty promises. What if companies want to advertise with him when he's a five-star recruit, but then decide otherwise once he's in college? The lack of a guarantee feels iffy, he said. Maybe I rub someone the wrong way by saying something or doing something that they didn't like. It could change, Proctor said. I'm not thinking about, oh, if I go to Iowa State, so-and-so is going to give me this money because I'm advertising their stuff. Another Power 5 level 2023 prospect in Iowa, Ankeny quarterback J.J. Cole, who has offers from Iowa State, Iowa, and Florida State, told the Register that schools have briefly discussed the issue with him, but not in detail. Cole said the topic has no impact on him now, and he doesn't think it will affect him when he signs with a school in December of 2022 or February of 2023. I'm going to college to play football, not just to try to make money, Cole said. When I'm about to make my college decision, it'll really come down to coaching staffs and which ones I feel like could develop me the most. Marion 2023 athlete Alex Mata, holds offers from Iowa, Iowa State, and Kansas State. He, too, said he can't see name, image, and likeness playing too big a role in his decision. The scholarship opportunity just to have the education would probably be more important for my family, Mata said. But getting paid just to do what you love is pretty much like playing in the NFL. It might just depend. Next up is Randy Peterson's column, College Football Open for Business Again. We'll have had a lot thrown at us by the time Iowa State opens the football season against Northern Iowa on September 4th at Jack Trice Stadium. The grand reopening of stadiums, a return of the wonderful smells that go along with tailgating, and players taking advantage of their pandemic-allowed super senior season. By then, the player opportunity for name, image, and likeness compensation that the NCAA should have figured out at least a year ago finally will be a thing. And by the time we hear the sweet sound of foot kicking football at the start of a game, plans will be moving even more steadily toward the 12-team playoff that's going to make college richer, while also adding a layer of teams to the Alabama-Clemson-Ohio State trio that seems to always headline the college football playoffs. They're game changers that could have been pushed forward last year until the focus rightfully shifted to figuring out how best to safely play sports amid a coronavirus pandemic that rocked everyone's world. I looked back on stuff that was in the news a year ago around this time. It was the second week of July last year when the Big Ten proclaimed its members would play conference-only football schedules. My initial reaction? See ya, Cy-Hawk 2020. A reality that followed by 24 hours, the cancellation of the 2020 Iowa State Fair. Talk about a 1-2 punch to the gut, former Iowa State coach and Iowa player Dan McCarney said a year ago, about a game that had been played consecutively since 1977. Those are fabrics of the state of Iowa. Even non-football fans look forward that special Saturday every season, that special fall tradition of the Iowa State-Iowa football game. No state fair, no Cy-Hawk, no trash talking among fans that I vowed I would never miss. What's changed? Cy-Hawk lives again. September 11th, Jack Trice Stadium at 2:30 p.m. Cyclones Athletics Director Jamie Pollard said about a month ago that the stadium will be back to 100% capacity. Tailgating for all six home games will be allowed. Kinnick Stadium is open for business, too. Fans are ready to rock again. Business establishments like restaurants and hotels can't wait to greet fans. For many of us, the season cannot get here quick enough. The next news from a year ago, college athletes finally felt empowered to speak up when they felt concerns needed addressing. Some players even threatened to opt out of the 2020 football season if demands for protection such as long-term medical coverage weren't addressed. Players were vocal. Iowa football players brought up disturbing issues that eventually led to longtime strength coach Chris Doyle's departure. What's changed? Administrators not only are listening, they're acting. Sometime in July, student athletes everywhere will have an opportunity to cash in on their name, image, and likeness in what's being hailed as a revolutionary decision that could alter athletes' lives. Would it be surprising to see recognizable mugs of Iowa State quarterback Brock Purdy and running back Brees Hall plastered on a billboard between Des Moines and Ames? Absolutely not. I'd be surprised if Iowa basketball player Jordan Bohannon's podcast doesn't soon include a money-paying sponsor or two. It's long past time college athletes have an opportunity to at least see what their brand might be worth on the open market. Next headline. There's been national chatter for a while about increasing the 4-team college football playoffs field. The nitty-gritty of that discussion obviously became overshadowed last year, Administrators had a tough enough time figuring out a 2020 playoff field among schools that didn't play the same number of games or comparable competition, then how to add 8 more teams to the mix. What's changed? Momentum for a 12-team playoff not only increased in recent weeks, it's likely happening. The 4-team format has been very popular and is a big success. A 4-person working group within the college football playoffs combined to say in a statement, but it's important that we consider the opportunity for more teams and more student athletes to participate in the playoff. After reviewing numerous options, we believe this proposal is the best option to increase participation, enhance the regular season, and grow the national excitement of college football. More discussion will lead to more discussion, and eventually, possibly in 5 years, the playoffs will be increased to 12 teams. And the final story from last year, I'll never forget a register picture taken inside Jack Trice Stadium during last season's opening game against Louisiana. No fans. Only families from players and staff were admitted. It's a picture I never again want to see. Fall is about stadiums full of fans, not what transpired on the Cyclones' opening day. Fall also is about experiences outside the stadium, pregame traffic jams, and mingling. Fans were robbed of that last in 2020. What's changed? College football is open for business again. Turning to the next page of the sports section, here's an article about the gymnastics Olympic trials in St. Louis. WISCUS shows Minnesota its mistake. The Minnesota Athletics Department would have been better sitting this one out. No sooner had Shane WISCUS been introduced as a member of the U.S. men's gymnastics team for the Tokyo Olympics on Saturday night, then the department posted a congratulatory tweet, complete with not one, not two, but 3 photos of WISCUS competing in his Minnesota uniform. A uniform that now qualifies as a relic, given Minnesota's decision last fall to cut its men's gymnastics team. I have a lot of things in my head right now, WISCUS said when he was asked about the tweet. Oh, I can just bet. WISCUS was among the most vocal critics after Minnesota announced in October that it was cutting 3 men's sports, gymnastics, tennis, and indoor track. And he hasn't backed off an inch. When Stanford reversed its decision to cut 11 sports last month, WISCUS took a screenshot of the announcement and sent it to Minnesota Athletic Director Mark Coyle. You can be sure a few more nasty grams are in store. I have not had time to look at my phone quite yet, WISCUS said, less than an hour after learning he was going to Tokyo. We'll definitely have to send Mr. Mark Coyle a message or two. Coyle said COVID-19 was partially to blame for his decision to cut the 3 sports, saying the pandemic had decimated Minnesota's budget and left the Gophers with a shortfall of between $45 and $65 million. Now, I'm no math genius, but I fail to see how cutting a gymnastics program with a $750,000 budget does much to wipe out that big of a deficit. Especially when 4 months later, you hire a basketball coach who you will pay almost $2 million a year, and have a football coach who made almost $4.3 million last year. But that's just me. Men's gymnastics programs are low-hanging fruit for athletic directors who lack imagination, fiscal discipline, or both, and find themselves with budgets awash in red ink. God forbid you should have one less football assistant, or scrap those plans to add a new wing to the Taj Mahal of practice facilities when you can cut a program that costs you the equivalent of pennies. And because smaller sports, like men's gymnastics, get scant time in the spotlight, athletic directors can take comfort in knowing no one will raise much of a stink if they disappear. But it's lazy. Worse, it has a ripple effect that will eventually hurt the U.S. Olympic movement. Of the five men who made the Olympic team Saturday night, every one of them came through an NCAA program. Brody Malone competes at Stanford and is the current NCAA champion. Yule Moldauer helped Oklahoma win three NCAA titles. Sam Mikulic was a two-time NCAA champion when he was at Michigan, where he also led the Wolverines to two team titles. Alec Yoder competed at Ohio State. When these programs are cut, as they have been with shocking speed in the last decade, where is the next generation supposed to come from? It should send a message to all the athletic directors and university presidents out there that if they're thinking about adding sports, that men's gymnastics is thrilling, said Brett McClure, the men's national team director. And it breeds excellence and Olympians. Oh, schools love to brag on their Olympians and promote the medals they win as if they're their very own. But when it comes to sustaining the kind of support that actually makes a difference, too many are quick to cry that there's nothing but dust bunnies in their pockets. Minnesota is happy to congratulate Wiskus now, but where were these folks when he was forced to move to the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Training Center after his team was cut? That kind of upheaval typically does not make for good Olympic preparation. Coyle and the Minnesota Bean Counters knew Wiskus was on the Olympic track. He was part of the U.S. team that finished fourth at the 2019 World Championships and was one of the gymnasts sent to an event in Tokyo last year that Olympic organizers used to prove they could pull off next month's games. But it made not one iota of difference in their calculations. It was just like one thing after another, Wiskus said. I've just been through the ringer, and I kind of told myself that I've been through enough and I'm ready to show what I can do at this competition. And ready to show Minnesota what a big mistake it made. Just thank you for the time there, Wiskus said when asked what he'd say to people in Minnesota's athletic department. And happy I got out when I did. End quote. That story was from USA Today columnist Nancy Armour. I'll finish up sports today with one last story. This is the Dan Gelston story titled Bush Ends Hendricks Winning Streak. And the dateline is Long Pond, Pennsylvania. Kyle Busch came through in the clutch, even when he raced without one. Busch busted Hendrick Motorsports' winning streak and denied the organization a shot at NASCAR history when he raced to his second victory of the season Sunday at Pocono Raceway. He needs to give credit to his tag team partner. Busch, runner-up in Saturday's Pocono race, led a few laps early until a leak in number 18 Toyota's transmission left the car stuck in fourth gear. Busch had a Joe Gibbs Racing crew member jump into his car and work on the shift stick. I'm going to need a push truck to get to victory laps, to get to victory lane because I have no clutch, Busch said on the radio. The 2.5-mile tri-oval wreaked havoc on fuel, and William Byron and Denny Hamlin saw their shot at the checkered flag disappear over the final five laps when they ran out of gas. Sometimes these races aren't always won by the fastest car, Busch said. Hamlin faded to 14th. Fuel mileage got us the last 2 weeks, Hamlin said. We can't see the checkered right now. Kyle Larson, whose blown tire on the last lap cost him a win Saturday, was second for Hendrick Motorsports. Hendrick had won six straight cup races, including Alex Bowman's victory Saturday in the first race of Pocono's doubleheader. Hendrick was trying to become the first team since NASCAR's modern era began in 1972 to win seven straight races. Bowman started the streak in May at Dover, and Chase Elliott followed the next week at Texas. Larson then ripped off three straight points victories at Charlotte, Sonoma, and last week at Nashville, and squeezed in the $1 million All-Star race for four wins total, all while Hendrick Motorsports became the winningest organization in NASCAR history. Brad Keselowski was third, Kevin Harvick fourth, and Bubba Wallace was fifth in his best finish of the season for Michael Jordan's 231X team. Urban Youth. Larson met with 40 students at the Urban Youth Racing School, and he announced plans to race in the school's go-kart race in August in Philadelphia. The Philly-based program that creates opportunities in racing for minorities developed a deeper relationship with Larson after he was suspended last season for using a slur during an iRacing event. Larson often calls or Zooms with the students and bought the school racing simulators. That does it for sports, and we'll turn now to the life section of the Register. The story featured on the front page there is titled, Creating Bonds. Iowa City Woman's Online Yiddish Class Creates Bonds Across America, and this is written by Dick Hakes as a special to the Iowa City Press Citizen. There are a couple of photographs accompanying this story. Both are of groups of people. The first one is a group of people sitting in a circle outdoors on a green lawn. They're all in folding chairs of various sorts. And the caption says, Yiddish class members celebrated their first in-person meeting recently with this toast and potluck dinner at the Iowa City home of Judy Liskin Gasparo after a year of Zoom sessions. Many called the class a bonding experience that kept them active and engaged during the pandemic. Members from three other states traveled here for the event. And in the photograph, all of the participants are wearing t-shirts and shorts or jeans or other pants, and they're sitting in their folding chair. Some are holding pieces of paper. Some have a laptop on their lap, a computer laptop. One's got a guitar strapped across her shoulders, and they're all holding up their glasses or cans of beverage and giving a cheer together as they are celebrating, as the caption mentions. And here is that story written by Dick Hakes. Linda Wirtz says she had a typical Jewish family upbringing as a child in New York City. My parents only spoke Yiddish when they didn't want us kids to know what they were talking about, she said, with a grin. Still, Wirtz absorbed some knowledge of this ancient, in quotes, mother tongue, and then in parentheses, mama lotion of her people. She was especially fond of the old Yiddish children's tunes and beloved holiday songs. Decades later, as an Iowa City resident, with the COVID-19 pandemic looming, she decided to start an online Yiddish language class through the local synagogue, the Agudas Achim congregation. It slowly blossomed into more than just a local educational forum on Zoom. Friends and family from six other states and Canada bonded with the Iowa City online class as often as three times per week during a time when people stuck at home craved contact and support from their peers. We discovered that people were hanging on after class just to talk, she said. So we added 15 minutes before and after the Zoom class just for that purpose. At her urging, retired applied linguist and Spanish professor Judy Liskin Gasparo brought her language teaching skills to the group as co-instructor. Eventually, the class grew to nearly 20 members. It was a challenge, Liskin Gasparo said. I knew Spanish and French, but zero Yiddish. I made a lot of mistakes in the beginning. She is amazing, countered Wirtz. She is the reason it is as big as it is. Liskin Gasparo confirmed that Yiddish is believed to have originated in the 9th century from Hebrew/Aramaic/German roots. It is written using the Hebrew alphabet, but has letters for vowels that Hebrew does not have. Like Hebrew and Arabic, Yiddish text is read right to left. The class has met twice a week since April of 2020 with a focus on conversational Yiddish and Yiddish culture. 3 months in, a smaller spin-off group was added to spend an hour a week to learn the Yiddish alphabet and read articles in the Yiddish language press, plus poetry and children's literature. The Cat in the Hat was the first book we read entirely in Yiddish, Liskin Gasparo said. More complex work followed. Zoom sessions for the larger class often open with a song, which the group studies and then sometimes sings, Wurtz leading with her guitar. She said, because it is hard to sing together on Zoom, the class is usually muted until the chorus, when it is easier for all to join in. The traditional old songs, Wurtz reported, range from sad to joyous, lullabies to love songs. Some are hauntingly mournful, such as the beloved Oifin Pripchik, and I'm sorry, I am definitely mispronouncing some of these words, which describes children learning the Yiddish alphabet next to a warm kitchen fire. The song tells them the alphabet contains, quote, the tears and weeping of our people, end quote. Before World War II, there were said to be some 11 million Yiddish speakers worldwide. Because of the Holocaust and subsequent aging of the population, the estimate is 600,000 Yiddish speakers exist today. That generation is mostly gone now, Wurtz said. We want to do what we can to preserve Yiddish and the songs. Earlier this month, the class celebrated its first year of existence and the potential end of the pandemic with an in-person potluck at the home of Liskin Gasparo. It was a rousing affair. Some members traveled from New York City and New Jersey, plus an Arizona class member who is fluent in the language. Class members wore custom-designed T-shirts with a Star of David marking Iowa City on the outline of a state map on the back. The front of the shirt proclaims the phrase, "Don't ask," in Yiddish, part of an inside joke enjoyed by the class. Wurtz explained that Zoom sessions during COVID began with, "Well, how are you?" After which the standard class response was a humorous, "Don't ask." The potluck was launched with the traditional L'chaim toast, which you might remember from Fiddler on the Roof, as meaning to life. Participants expressed with emotion their gratitude for the class, sang the old songs, and feasted on New York City bagels, kasha, and other Jewish and American potluck delicacies. The two local instructors were proud to hear members call this class a silver lining that saved their sanity during the difficult months of pandemic isolation. They will continue their Zoom sessions to keep this shtetl going, the Yiddish word for a small, close-knit community. We made the best of being quarantined, said local class member Frank Solomon. We came out of it speaking basic Yiddish and singing it, too. Will the bonding continue if the class is concluded at some point down the road? People who study together can become a community, Liskin Gasparo said, and the community can outlast the class. For more information, search Leonard Nimoy's Mamaloshin, a Yiddish story, on YouTube to hear him recite a phrase from Hamlet in Yiddish, plus reveal tales about growing up in a Yiddish-speaking neighborhood in Boston. Search the same site for Chava Albertstein's Oifin Pripetchik to hear a beautiful rendition of this cherished Yiddish folk song. And again, I apologize, I am definitely mispronouncing many of these words. If you have any questions, you can give us a call here at IRIS. Back to the cover of the Life section, there is an article at the bottom of the page that is titled, Heart Problems Can Worsen If Sleep Apnea Goes Untreated. And this is written by the American Heart Association News. Can't sleep properly? If you also have a heart condition or risk factors for one, ignoring the problem could further harm your health. A new scientific statement finds, heart doctors should pay more attention to a common sleep disorder that can worsen heart disease, but often is unrecognized and undertreated, according to the report from the American Heart Association, published Monday in its journal Circulation. The scientific statement calls for increased screening and greater awareness of obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, in people with cardiovascular risk factors or conditions. OSA, characterized by snoring and disrupted sleep, can worsen heart conditions. That can create a cycle in which heart problems then worsen sleep apnea. It also is a risk factor for a heart rhythm disorder called atrial fibrillation, as well as sudden cardiac death. Advances in treatment for OSA can help, but are often overlooked, the report finds. Patients report better mood, less snoring, less daytime sleepiness, improved quality of life, and work productivity with OSA treatment. Dr. Yerem Yegyezerians, chair of the report's writing group, said in a news release. He is a professor of medicine and the Leonard Perkins Family Endowed Chair in Cardiology at the University of California, San Francisco. Screening advances have changed how sleep apnea is diagnosed and treated, he said. Patients no longer need to spend the night at sleep study centers. They can use FDA-approved sleep devices that they take home and send back to their doctors for assessment. And continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP machines, are no longer the only form of treatment. Other therapeutic options include positional therapy, weight loss, oral appliances, and surgery. Between 40 and 80% of people with cardiovascular disease also have sleep apnea. Symptoms include snoring, lapses in breathing, fragmented sleep, and daytime sleepiness. It affects about 34% of middle-aged men and 17% of middle-aged women. OSA has been linked to several cardiovascular complications, including high blood pressure, especially when it is difficult to treat, stroke, worsening heart failure, and heart disease, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and pulmonary hypertension, a type of high blood pressure that affects the arteries in the lungs and the heart. It also occurs more often in people at high risk for heart attacks. The report recommends different OSA screenings based on a person's heart condition and its severity. The final story from the Register's Life section is written by Melissa Erickson, and the title is Pro Tips and Tricks for Keeping Your Home Organized. The detritus of life tends to pile up, making it an obstacle to keeping a home neat and tidy. To stay ahead, professional organizers advise not getting behind in the first place. Keep up with small tasks daily. Maintenance and planning don't happen magically. Intentionally staying on top of these daily tasks means you won't face monumental cleanups or organizing, which can reduce your daily stress and leave you with more time for fun family time, said Amy Tokos, president of the National Association of Productivity and Organizing Professionals and owner of Freshly Organized. Keeping up with the little things, like clearing off the bathroom counter or the nightstand daily, means that you don't get overwhelmed with a pile, said Darla DeMauro, a certified professional organizer and owner of Heartwork Organizing near Philadelphia. It makes it easier to take care of routine household maintenance, which means things will last longer or can be repaired more quickly. One of my favorite, quote, adult habits that keeps my home running smoothly is my morning sponge switch. Every morning, I swap out my kitchen sponge, said DeMauro, author of Sort and Succeed and The Upbeat Organized Home Office. After hanging two fresh towels and putting a fresh sponge by the sink, DeMauro pops yesterday's towels and sponge in the wash, since they dried overnight. It's a quick little habit, like making the bed. No big deal. Always organized, DeMauro said. Keep a child-sized broom and dustpan in the bathroom. Every other day, I shake the bathroom rugs and sweep up, she said. It keeps the bathroom tidy, keeps the rugs in good shape, takes less than 2 minutes, and doesn't require a charger. Having the broom in the bathroom means I don't have to stop what I'm doing to take care of my home. Clear off the top of your nightstand every day. With two drawers that are well organized, I have space for all of my nighttime routines right at my fingertips, DeMauro said. Little things make a big difference, Toko said. Stay organized with the National Association of Productivity and Organizing Professionals Daily Dozen Tidy Tips. And here they are. Make your bed. Check your appointments and have your to-do list for the day to set your day up for success. Review your calendar each morning with family. Who has activities? What carpools are set up? What's the plan for dinner? Wipe down all sink countertops in the morning and at night. Last person in the morning and night squeegees the shower. Sweep floors. Sort mail at the front door and put junk mail into recycling or shred following your community guidelines. Then file important documents immediately. Take 5 minutes to unsubscribe to any emails/subscriptions or services you no longer need. Sign any permission slips or documents that need to go out in the mail or backpacks before wrapping up your day to avoid the morning scramble. Pack lunches and snacks. Sort laundry daily into a divided hamper so it doesn't pile up. That does it for the Register today. Here is a story from the USA Today. It's a fact check article, and the title is MSG is safe to eat, doesn't cause neurological issues. And this is written by Miriam Fauzia. While the COVID-19 pandemic may have forced many Americans across the nation indoors, it also has encouraged them to expand their palates with adventurous spices, natural ingredients, meal kits, and home cooking, food industry experts say. But one ingredient to watch out for, claims one social media post, is MSG, or monosodium glutamate. Deadly brain toxin, in quotes, reads a graphic shared in a January 26, 2019 Facebook post, which has recently gotten attention online. And also in quotes, MSG causes serious neurological disorders and other physiological health problems, end quote. It then lists a litany of other health problems such as headache, infantile obesity, numbness, heart palpitations, and weakness. To emphasize its claim, the post includes an image of Accent seasoning, the main ingredient of which is MSG, edited to add the skull and crossbones hazard symbol. MSG is a common flavor enhancer and preservative that has been in global use for the past 100 years. Its unsavory reputation has been largely based on flawed scientific studies in animals and humans, which have been debunked by more recent research. What is MSG? First discovered by Japanese biochemist Kikune Ikeda, MSG is made up of sodium and glutamate, one of the most abundant amino acids found within the human body and nature. Glutamate plays a crucial role in neuromuscular development, metabolism, and many other vital biological functions. MSG, by itself, doesn't have much flavor, but when it's added into certain foods, it stimulates and heightens taste buds on our tongues that sense umami, a Japanese portmanteau meaning a pleasant, savory taste. When Ikeda first happened on MSG in 1907, he had distilled it from a glutamate-rich seaweed broth used extensively in Japanese cuisine. Today, MSG is made by fermenting starch, corn, wheat, beets, or other sugar-rich foods with bacteria that eat the sugar and spit out proteins abundant in glutamic acid, an alternative form of glutamate. Foods like yogurt, kimchi, and sauerkraut also are made via fermentation. Humans have been eating glutamate-rich foods like tomatoes and cheese for centuries. MSG has long been associated with Chinese cooking, but it's also used to flavor Caribbean and Latin American sauces, Doritos, sandwiches at Chick-fil-A, low-sodium products, and many other processed foods. Dr. Stephen Prescott, president of the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation, wrote in The Oklahoman. Health concerns over MSG arose in 1968 after a Chinese-American doctor wrote a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine wondering if the flavor enhancer was the cause for his heart palpitations, numbness, and weakness felt whenever eating at a Chinese restaurant. The letter, published under the title Chinese Restaurant Syndrome, spawned a flurry of animal and human studies in which subjects were given MSG either through an injection or orally. One 1969 study by Washington University researcher Dr. John Olney found injecting significantly large doses under the skin of newborn mice led to impaired brain development, stunted growth, obesity, and infertility in female mice. Olney repeated the same experiment, this time giving MSG orally to rhesus monkeys, and came to a similar finding. But later, in 19 other monkey studies by other researchers, no one observed results anything like Olney's. In one human study, where 71 healthy people were given either MSG or a placebo, both groups complained of symptoms like headaches or numbness roughly at the same rate, even when participants were swapped to the other option. In following years, many organizations, including the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the National Academy of Sciences, the World Health Organization, and the American Medical Association, all declared MSG safe to eat. In 1992, the FDA launched a formal review of MSG's supposed ill effects, and in 1995, it concluded it was safe overall, although it may cause mild short-term reactions like headaches, numbness, and palpitations in a tiny part of the population. The report noted that the symptoms tended to occur in people who ate more than 3 grams of MSG without food. The typical serving of food with MSG added is less than 0.5 grams. Consuming 6 times that amount without food at one time is unlikely, the FDA said on its MSG questions and answers website. A 2009 study found dietary glutamate does not cross the blood-brain barrier, a system of blood vessels that regulates what goes in and out of the brain and spinal cord, in large amounts, and so is unlikely to affect brain function. A 2020 review of studies involving MSG also found many of its reported negative health effects, quote, have little relevance for chronic human exposure and are poorly informative as they are based on excessive dosing that does not meet with levels normally consumed in food products, end quote. The impact of MSG on weight has been less clear-cut. Some studies have suggested it can cause weight gain, but others show there is no connection between the two. Our rating? False. We rate the claim that MSG is a deadly brain toxin that causes neurological disorders and other health problems false, based on our research. MSG is a naturally occurring food substance that has been used for more than 100 years. Claims that it can be dangerous to human health are based on flawed scientific studies that have been debunked by more recent research. A small population of people may be sensitive to MSG, but the effects are short-term and not life-threatening. And with that, we'll turn back to the register to read Dear Abby. The headline of today's column is, Fortunate Man Finds Tears Falling Despite Life's Blessings. The first letter says, Dear Abby, I am a very fortunate 60-year-old male. I have a wonderful life, great kids, I'm a new grandfather, and I'm recently retired. I think I am a happy and overall positive person. Most people would be thrilled to have my life. However, I can't seem to stop crying. I tear up the end of every sad or romantic movie. I choke up when I'm around my loved ones, and it is only getting worse. I wonder if it is because of pain I experienced in my past, deaths of loved ones, divorce, etc., or fear about the future. Do you have any insight based on your experience? Signed, Tearing Up in Ohio. Abby says, Dear Tearing Up, the death of loved ones can make a person increasingly emotional. Being able to express emotion is a gift, not a disability. You may simply be a sensitive individual. But because you say this is only getting worse, in quotes, it might benefit you to discuss what's going on with your physician or a licensed mental health professional who can put your concerns to rest. A second letter says, Dear Abby, my ex-girlfriend and I have been good friends for the past 5 years. Even though our relationship didn't work out, I still want to be there for her as a friend. My ex isn't that financially responsible, nor is her family. I have loaned her thousands of dollars since our breakup, Abby. Part of me feels I'm being taken advantage of. However, the other part of me knows she doesn't have many friends. Should I continue helping? Signed, Lending a Helping Hand. Abby says, Dear Lending, there is a point after which, quote, helping becomes enabling. You reached that milestone years ago. It's time to let your ex-girlfriend suffer the consequences of her financial irresponsibility so you can focus on helping people who won't take advantage of your generosity. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Monday, June 28th, 2021. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa. That phone number is 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon each day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart is read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.